From San Antonio, Texas, in the 1994 Public Radio Conference, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. On this special edition of Tech Nation Live, please welcome my guests, Buzz Aldrin, space engineer, Gemini astronaut, Apollo 11 astronaut. Thank you. Via teleconferencing facilities from Colorado Springs, General Chuck Horner, Commander-in-Chief of the United States Space Command. Dr. Carolyn Hantoon, Director, NASA Johnson Space Center. Skip Johns, Associate Director for Technology, the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. And Dick McLeod, President of the United States Space Foundation. Welcome to this special live taping of Tech Nation, celebrating the 25th anniversary of the Apollo moon landing, looking at our presence in space today, and looking forward to our plans tomorrow. Buzz, I'd like to start with you. Nearly 25 years ago, you and Neil Armstrong and the historic Apollo 11 space mission walked on the moon. And it was one of those events that was so striking that we mark our lives by it. From time to time, people will ask each other, where were you when they landed on the moon? And I realize that you get to say, well, I was on the moon. did you know people say that?
I've noticed in the last several years that people almost have a compulsion to want to tell me where they were. And I've really tried to understand what the meaning of that is. And I've concluded, really, that the importance of that mission was not what happened up there on the moon. It was not what we brought back, the knowledge, the information. It was that millions of people around the world participated in things that they had been dreaming about. And they were a part of what happened then. And that's why they remember it. It was because something important happened in their lives.
Well, when was the last time somebody asked you a really new, really fresh question about your Apollo experience?
24 years ago. Now, there are a lot of questions that are always coming up, and they're about the same. There are variations on them. But you know, tomorrow, 33 years ago, is when Yuri Gagarin first went up into orbit. And shortly thereafter, we had a little episode in Cuba. And these events prompted the president, after Alan Shepard had made one suborbital flight, to make that pronouncement that it was the objective of our nation to send men to the moon and bring them back safely. 33 years ago. Now, I was at MIT working on a doctor's degree, and little did I know that 8 years later, I'd be participating in those missions.
Well, I'll tell you, I've had a year to think about this question, and I can't come up with one. So, and if you've had, everybody else has had 24. But if something occurs to you in the next 55 minutes, could you just jump in with the question?
I'll let you know.
That would be terrific. Now, the moon landing really were, in my mind, sort of the crown jewel of the space program. It captured us. It was such a feat. Independent of how stirring such a thing could be, what would you say were the three biggest accomplishments in the space program thus far?
I think the revolution in communication, where because of space and objects in space and satellites, we can transmit information that does not have mass. It has information back and forth. When we put objects that have mass up into space, it gets rather expensive to put them up and to bring them back down again, but not so with electronic means. And that's meant tying together parts of the world. It's meant giving us information about weather. And I think the second important contribution, other than the opportunities that everybody knows about for humans to go in space, is the reconnaissance of the solar system with the Grand Tour, the wonderful robotic spacecraft that we've sent that have visited one planet after another. And I'd say the third most important might be the reconnaissance, the information that we've been able to obtain that has given us information as to what our potential enemies may be doing, and they have the same kind of information or some information as to what we're doing. And I think that's led to a tremendous amount of opportunities for peace.
Anybody have anything to add to that?
You ain't seen nothing yet.
Thank you, Skip. Skip Johns of the White House.
I think we're going to continue to exploit the resource that space represents for us. And we will all be communicating with each other all over the world in a very easy and simple way. But it also means we'll be able to deliver educational opportunities. We'll understand the planet better so that our stewardship responsibility to keep it in one piece will be strengthened. And it's going to be an important place for the global community to get on with the work at hand.
Now, General Horner, I'd like to turn to you. Welcome from Colorado Springs. Many people were not aware that there was a consolidated military presence in space until Desert Storm. If you could, tell us the full scope of the U.S. Space Command.
Well, I think Desert Storm was best described as the first space war. The U.S. Space Command covers the needs of the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force in space. Primarily what we do is gather information, like Buzz pointed out, and also communicate it very rapidly over long distances. We also get the advantage of weather and other information like that from space. The Desert Storm experience showed another very important problem. That was the Scud missile. That's the first time we've seen ballistic missiles in warfare since World War II. And the space-based sensors we have left over from the Cold War were used to alert our people about the Scud launches against Riyadh, Israel, and Bahrain. So space is vital to modern warfare, and we certainly need to take a look at it. I'd also second Buzz's point about deterrence. I think the real value in space and warfare is avoiding war. The more we know about the enemy, the more they know about us, the more we know what's going on in the world, the less likely we are to get surprised and have to go into combat.
All right. Now let me turn to you, Carolyn, because this is the military side, and then there's the whole side, which most of us know from the NASA side. Now, Carolyn, you're director of the NASA Johnson Space Center and the first female NASA Center Director. I noticed they didn't give you a backwater. That's very good. So Mission Control works for you, the Astronaut Corps. Now the space station is consolidated under you. Let me just ask this. I worked for NASA, I've worked for DOD, I've done work for all these people. What's the relationship between NASA, the U.S. Space Command, the White House? Who wants to take that?
Well,
Skip, you go.
Sure, I'll be happy to take it. Basically, the NASA is carrying out the Space Act. The Department of Defense is carrying out its many missions, and the White House performs a coordinating role and is responsible for assuring that the presidents, whoever the president is, wishes are being followed within the law of the land. So coordination is done in our office at the Office of Science and Technology Policy, and presidential directives are issued, of which there are numbers that are standing now that call for a level of coordination between DOD, NASA, the intelligence community, and others who are engaged in space. We are at the present time working on a new space policy for the country and working cooperatively with DOD and with NASA and with others who are concerned about the utilization of those resources.
Now, some of the astronauts are in the military, and they're at NASA Johnson.
That's right.
And during the time they're there, how do they report to the military versus NASA?
When we select the shuttle astronauts, which we have been doing since 1978, we have asked each of the military services to nominate individuals for that selection process. So they do come from their military background as a nominee, but they enter into competition for astronaut selection with the civilian astronauts. And once they are on board and are trained, just as all the astronauts receive the same training, their missions are much the same. Sometimes in the past we've had military missions, and we have specifically chosen military astronauts to fly on those missions. Right now we are not flying any specific military missions, although there's some military payloads. So they are trained and treated the same as civilian employees from that viewpoint.
One of the points that's so important to understand of the benefits of the space program is not that we went to the moon or we orbited the Earth. Many of the technical benefits of the space program fall silently out of the efforts that are made. Dick McLeod, as president of the U.S. Space Foundation, could you tell us about how the Space Foundation recognizes these, not these side benefits, but these direct benefits?
Well, up until the 1980s, there really was no public recognition of either the scientists and engineers who produced new technologies or the companies that made successful commercial application of them. So with NASA, we agreed to establish the Space Technology Hall of Fame. Nominations come from each of the centers. Each year, we form a panel of prominent Americans, ranging from the president of Coca-Cola to the editor-in-chief of Popular Science magazine, and many others, and they vote on these technologies and the impact they've had on our lifestyle on Earth. And then they are inducted into the Hall of Fame, which was done just last week with laser angioplasty, for example, originally developed for the space program. Another was liquid-cooled garments, which were developed to cool the astronauts' bodies, now being used by the multiple sclerosis victims to cool them and give them some relief from their pain. Many, many other examples exist, primarily in the recognized best in the medical field. Mm-hmm. And when you stop and think of it, it's logical. NASA has to prepare for remote medicine, that is, taking care of people, understanding what's happening to them when they're far away, and being able to understand what to do. Therefore, they have a tremendous medical program, life sciences program.
Well, now I think we've got everybody understood where we're coming from. Now we're off to the races. For many years, there were only two serious players in space, and that was the Americans and the Russians. Is this still true?
Oh, definitely not. We are building a space station, as you well know, with the cooperation of the Japanese, the Canadians, the entire European Space Agency, as well as the Russians with the United States. And talk about a truly international space station, it's going to be one. Each country is bringing what they do best to the station. And because we're all joining together, we're going to have a more productive capability on orbit, which is what we're doing it for scientists of all the countries to work in. And because we've joined with the Russians in this program, we're going to get there faster, and it's going to be a little bit cheaper, and we're going to have more crew members on orbit than we were going to be able to have with our own space station. So we are taking the best, I think, from all the countries and putting them together, but they are truly international partners in this space station. So I think that right now, that isn't past, that's present. That's what's happening. So I think that's an exciting aspect of an international program.
Now, is this our first departure? I mean, today we know Apollo Soyuz. There's been a tremendous history of working with the Russians, and now we have other partners in space. But today, what's going on today? Are we all an American space program that is now joining with the Russians? What's happening?
Well, the French are launching a lot of commercial payloads, and they managed to do it a little cheaper than we're able to do right at the present time. We have a number of expendable rockets that have been used for some of the heavier commercial payloads and some new rocket launchers that are coming on for some of the lighter ends of things. After the Challenger accident, we decided, the government decided not to use the shuttle for commercial payloads. But the French and the Chinese and the Russians are certainly giving us a run for money in terms of being able to launch and offer launch services at considerably reduced prices.
The key to that is right now, in fact, where we used to launch most of the satellites into space outside of the Soviet Union, today 70% of the satellites are being launched by other than the United States. We have lost the market over the last 5 to 6 years.
Most of those have fallen to Ariane, which was developed in cooperation with the French government. They are launching in Africa, and they have been very successful in capturing the launch market. We continue to be by far the world leaders with regard to satellites, and we used to have 90% of the launches, but we've lost a lot. We haven't been making the investments necessary to stay competitive. The Chinese are coming online with Long March, and the Russians have a couple of very competitive systems. The attractive thing about working with the Russians is that our companies in this country, Lockheed, Boeing, McDonnell Douglas, and others, are forming joint ventures, and all of those serve to help pull Russia toward the markets of the West, which is where we'd like to have them.
So we've learned two things in what we've just talked about. The first is that this is not R&D or military, all the launches and that part of it, part of the space program. But in fact, there's a market out there. It's actually a commercial market, a world commercial market, in launching into space. And as soon as we've learned that, we found out that we lost the edge. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. You're listening to Tech Nation Live from the Public Radio Conference in San Antonio, Texas. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guests today are Apollo astronaut Buzz Aldrin, General Chuck Horner, Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Space Command, Dr. Carolyn Huntoon, Director of NASA Johnson Space Center, Skip Johns of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, and Dick McLeod of the U.S. Space Foundation. Now, General Horner, I want to ask you, first of all, General Horner, you're not with us today because there was a stay put order. Can you tell us what a stay put order is and how this came about?
You got me. Not familiar. My duties kept me here because we had the head of the Brazilian space military visiting, and so I was at breakfast with them this morning.
Ah.
I'd like to add a point on the robustness of our space lift. It's a serious problem from the standpoint of the military because the high cost keeps us from getting systems on orbit we need on orbit. As a result, we've joined together with NASA and the commercial side to make sure that our space launch facilities operated by the Air Force, Vandenberg and Patrick or Cape Canaveral, give priority to those customers so we can have a robust industry and we can also have NASA and the commercial on orbit as cheaply as possible so the military can get there as cheaply as possible.
Now, where do you, General Horner, where do we need to go from your point of view, from a military point of view, in space?
Well, I think that Skip Johns and the White House are providing excellent leadership to get us reliably and cheaply on orbit so that we can do the basic research, the basic science, technology demonstrations, and so we can also provide robust capability in communications, intelligence, weather, ballistic missile warning, and things of this nature that the military gets from space.
Now, one of the things that I understand about engineering projects when we look at technology is that we have new technology we want to develop. Whenever we do a thing, any project, we have the technology at hand, new technology to develop, the resources we need, that's the expertise of the personnel and the ability to put these together, and of course some new parameters such as the impact on the environment, which we understand so much now. Now, once we have engineered a project, we think the problems are solved and we can do it again. Now, 35 years ago, we started with the moon project, the Apollo project, with 30-year-old technology, and it took us 10 years to get to the moon. If we started today, how long would it take us to put a person on the moon? Buzz.
Well, I think it's only a guess. It depends on what rockets we might be willing to use and what is the driving force. The driving force 30 years ago was competition with the Soviets. We don't seem to have that competition and a particular deadline, and until we do, it's going to stretch on out and be postponed because of the pressure of short-term interests. So,
well, how long?
The Russians have a rocket that could very nicely get us back to the moon, but it is inappropriate for us to use that rocket right now.
Well, this is where I'm at. everyone's thinking, well, we went to the moon. Can't we just kind of sign up and get out there again? You know, like we'll be there next year. Like, don't you have one on the launch pad? I mean,
well, I think the infrastructure that was required to get to the moon, you said yourself, took 10 years to get it. I think everyone remembers very well the Mercury program. They may forget a little bit about Gemini, which proved a lot of the technology that we needed for the Apollo program. And then you might remember that we didn't do a lot of test and checkout with spacecraft for the Apollo. We launched one to check the system. We launched another one to see about the Earth orbit situation. And then we started heading toward the moon. And we did it in a very good fashion. And NASA's very proud of that, with the whole nation supporting. But we do not have in our stock right now spacecrafts and rockets that can go do that again. They're on display around the country at Smithsonian, at the various NASA centers, but they're not present there. The technology that got us to the moon, we still have that technology, but I don't think anyone would want to go use that 30-year-old technology to go to the moon this time. There have been studies done. There are people interested in what it would take to get back to the moon, and I think it is certainly possible for us to do it. The exact time would depend on how much money and how much emphasis this country wanted to put on doing that.
Okay, if we had all the money, what's the minimum maximum it would take, number of years, to go to the moon? Skip. Oh, right when he's getting a glass of water. And we get him there.
I would say that somewhere between 6 and 10 years. We know how to get there. It would just take a commitment to do that. But I would argue what we would like to understand better is how man could travel for longer periods of time. And space station will bring an important insight into extended operations for man in a weightless environment. There are serious problems related with exposure to a weightless environment with regard to bone loss and other aspects that we just don't understand well. And I would argue that for the long pull, we can benefit greatly from the information that we'll gain from space station, and that it's a community of nations who will be able to gain that.
Well, I agree completely, and I'd like to add to that what we learned from the moon, and I think the many missions that went there were only there for hours, though, really. If we go back to the moon, and when we go back to the moon, it should be to set up a base and operate from there for a period of time. The information we need for that, we will get from the space station. We do not have that information today. Our Russian colleagues do not have that information today. We need to understand about operating life support systems for long, indefinite periods of time. We need to understand the healthcare aspects, the muscle loss, the bone loss, the blood cell loss, etc. So we've got a lot of work to do, and we can do it in Earth orbit in a space station while we are also returning technology to Earth for Earth benefit. And so I think that's a very important part we ought to remember.
There are some differences, too, in the political situation. When John Kennedy took over as president, his transition team recommended against Project Mercury having anything to do with it because it was too risky. After the Bay of Pigs, when he wanted something major to call the attention of the public to what they could do, in part, that was a reason he gave for calling for the Apollo program. At that same time, when a space committee was formed in Congress, it was made up of the chairman of all the standing committees. So when you had a meeting of that committee and said, we're going to do the following, Lyndon Johnson knew exactly what was going to happen. They were all going to go out of that committee and make it happen because they had the power to do it. Those things don't exist today. The other factor, which Dr. Huntoon pointed out, is that we were much more willing to take risk in those days than we are today. We're much more institutionalized and concerned about checking out things. If you just drive through Cape Canaveral Air Force Station today and look at all the launch pads used in the Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, and the signs that give you the dates of when they took off, and you realize that some of those launches from the same pads were as short as 6 days apart. And today we take a year to get into space. If you want, you got a satellite sitting on a rocket ready to go out, you don't know when it's going to go, and I suggest General Horner might have a few comments about that.
Yes, General Horner.
Well, one of the problems that's plagued the military is that the reliability of our takeoff time. We need to get airborne on schedule so that we can assure the soldier in the field that space is going to be there when he needs it. And we've, over time, have gotten away from the urgency of space. So maybe if this radio program helps us all realize that space is important, that we need to be businesslike in how we run it, we'll benefit the nation from a science technology, from a commercial aspect and a military aspect.
And some part of that challenge that the general is speaking of, the way that you get competitive in space is you shorten the time on the pad, you shorten the turnaround time, and you shorten the amount of stuff you have to throw away when you make a launch. And so if we can get to the position where we are mostly flying into space and flying back, whether that's on a rocket or an aircraft-like device, that's where the real potential breakthrough lies. And but a good part of that is not a cheap spacecraft. It's one that turns around quickly and therefore doesn't require a huge infrastructure on the base that's eating you up day after day.
Right. You know, we often get lost sort of in the engineering aspects of this, saying, gosh, how do we get up there? How do we get back? How do we do what we're going to do? But a major reason for the benefits of space is the science we're able to do in space. Why don't you tell us about that, Carolyn?
Well, I was just sitting here thinking about the mission that's up there right now. We have a shuttle crew, as you well know, in orbit doing some radar studies of the Earth. And it's a tremendous capability, and they've already sent pictures back which have just really enthused the scientists that are looking at them. And at the same time, they're taking these radar images of the Earth and trying to document exactly what has happened to our Earth over time so that we can continue this documentation in months to come. They're taking photographs for the scientists to understand just how good their radar is, and they're getting ground truth from the scientists all over the world. So this is a small step on the mission to planet Earth, but it's a very important step, and one that will help us understand our environment. The other aspect, of course, is the studies that we've got planned for space station. And I've been working quite a bit with the Russian scientists getting ready for a trip to the Russian space station Mir. We're sending one of our astronauts, who's now in training in Russia, up to Mir next March for 3 months. And he will take with him devices that we have been using and have developed for our space station. And the Russians have not had a chance to use these devices on orbit, so it will be a preparation for our station as well as gaining early information. So we're quite enthused about that.
So there's an internationalization going on of space, both from an engineering point of view and from a science point of view.
That's right, very much so.
It's important, I think, to keep in mind that in many of the problems that we face on Earth, especially the environmental problems, can't be solved by one nation. They have to be solved by all nations working together. So when you've got 14 nations of the world involved in station and coming to understand the kinds of problems that, and these are the strongest nations in the world, you have the opportunity to move quickly to for those elements that are going to enhance the stewardship of the Earth, keep us from destroying it.
Certainly, that's what brought about the quick relationship between the Russians and the United States on the space station, when that obviously is a clear strength of them as well as ourselves, and something that we could work together on. It came about in Vancouver, finally, with the discussions between President Yeltsin and President Clinton, when they decided that this is a strength, this is an area we can agree on, this is an area we can work well together on, and we're going to make it happen.
Some of the point that General Horner was making about the stability that's brought about by understanding what your potential adversaries are engaged in, so mistakes are the things that would most likely have put the country at risk over the past couple of decades. And the more you work together, the fewer the opportunities are that one is going to make a mistake about what the other is up to.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Let's take a short break. Welcome back to Tech Nation Live. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guests today are Buzz Aldrin, General Chuck Horner, Dr. Carolyn Huntoon, Skip Johns, and Dick McLeod. Let's talk about risk. I mean, this is true about the Apollo missions. We were in a sort of a golden age in the sense that, well, let's test it live, like this radio show. Let's test it live. So many things happened. Gus Grissom back in the Mercury program, certainly Apollo 13 with Jim Lovell and the problems that they had, how close we came there, and then again with Challenger. What's happened to the American public about that, and how is that affecting our ability to move forward in space?
In part, I think the American public has been led to believe that space and the operation of the shuttle in particular now is routine, and it certainly is not. It's probably the most complex machine ever built by humans. It has tremendous capabilities, but things can go wrong, and people need to understand this is an R&D program. And I think perhaps we make it look too easy. Certainly in the Mercury, Gemini, Apollo era, in every flight, those astronauts were doing something that had never been done before by humans. Now we see people going up and repeating some of the things that have been done before, and perhaps that's not seen as quite as risky, but a single puncture of a suit or a misstep or many other things could cause catastrophe. So it is, and you're sitting on about 7 million pounds of explosive when they start off. Any of those factors would tend to call it risk. That's right.
I think the incursions of the media and the awareness that they have and the immediate response that they give to the American people of everything that happens tends to make government agencies a bit more cautious about their future because of this instant communication.
Bureaucracies are inherently risk adverse, but one of the problems, of course, is these assets are very expensive, and so the cost of replacing them in some cases would preclude your being able to replace them. It makes you very careful with those assets. You are talking about $1 billion or more a piece in some cases in some of our more complex satellites. Of course, the orbiter is a very expensive piece of hardware. And all of these launchers are in the $200 million a pop class, not counting ground support. They go on down to perhaps 30 million for small launches, but nevertheless, this is high-priced equipment, and one would like not to make mistakes.
No mistakes.
Well, I think also in discussing risk, we have to be very careful that we're not looking back over 30 years and saying, "Oh, we were so risky back then." I think we did at the time what was our engineers and scientists and our astronauts thought was acceptable for what the knowledge we had and what they were going to do. And I think each mission was planned, and of course Buzz could speak more to this than I, but the astronauts were fully involved in understanding what they were being asked to do and how good the hardware was and all. And that's true today. We still have the most valuable assets on orbit are the human beings that we put up there. And I think NASA, and I know the government takes these as our highest priority to protect their health and safety. And so you will always hear that as a common thread in the agency, that we're not going to do anything that puts our crew at more risk than we should.
Now,
I think all of the crew who were involved in those early pioneering days would attest to the fact that the Saturn rocket was one of the most marvelous pieces of machinery that this nation ever put together. And in retrospect, we certainly regret that we had to stop flying the Saturn rockets and wait 6 years without one American human being going into space between the Apollo Soyuz flight that we flew on a Saturn rocket and when the shuttle first began to fly. And looking back on those days, for a nation that accepted the challenge of going to the moon and did it in such a marvelous fashion, to then follow that by not flying at all for 6 years seems inconceivable. And I just want to remind the public of that.
You know, there's something that's kind of interesting about engineers, and that is that I've seen engineers as a group sit there, and if they don't really have a project they want to work on, that kind of goes on and on and on and on. And then if there's a huge one, we don't have any time, our schedule's filled up, but it's something we want to do, something that moves us along. Suddenly, everyone's mobilized. Everybody goes forward. Something is stirred here. We're talking about there is difficulty in getting the public excited. There is difficulty in getting Congress to go along. There is difficulty in all these things to get us a project. Let's say we were able to. Let's say we're able to get a stirring project that we could mobilize. What would we do? I don't want to hear space station. Everybody's going to say space station. What would be that single stirring goal, like the moon? Would we do?
No, it's tourism in space. It's providing the opportunity. It's providing the opportunity for the American people to participate in what they're investing in. And we're not that far away. We need a safer, we need a cheaper launch vehicle, and then we need to share the risk and share the expense. And those things are done all the time. When the National Commission on Space went around the country in 1985, 1986, to ask the people in forums what they wanted to do, they wanted to fly in space. They wanted to participate in this. We have virtual reality simulators now, and those can get out into the video game world, and people can really start to experience what zero gravity could be like. And one of these days, what was also mentioned in these forums in 1985, some kind of a space lottery where you can take a chance and invest. We see throughout the nation what is going on in the world of taking a risk with your financial resources in gambling. And those opportunities of up-to-date, really enlightened marketing, once we have a safer launch vehicle and a cheaper launch vehicle, will open up tourism. And that, I think, should be our objective, because once you increase the volume of the use of space, the cost is going to go down, and everything is going to become much easier. It's like the government subsidy of the postal service for the airplane began to get more and more airplanes into the business, and pretty soon the airlines started operating.
What do you think, Dick?
Well, one of the scientists at the National Space Symposium last week said, we're going to have people in space in large numbers because they're going to demand it. When you look at the population that's likely to go up, and over 44% in a recent poll again reaffirmed that they would want to go into space, the people who are 60 and over have the means to do it. They have the desire to be someplace where they can relax. They now go to Florida or the Caribbean or whatever, many cases to get away from the cold and to take care of their arthritis and so forth. In space, they don't have to worry as much about arthritis. They won't have the pull of gravity pulling those bones together, and they will, as a matter of fact, be more relaxed and comfortable. And they can ride home, and eventually they'll be able to garden, and they'll be able to do whatever they want to do.
May I bring up...
You don't have visits from the grandkids all the time, but...
May I bring a sad but practical note to the discussion, and that is that we are in a mood in this country and in Washington to cut the budget and get our costs down. There are some who would, in fact, terminate our manned space flight efforts in order to save money, shorten our horizons about what the American public and what the country can look to in visions ahead, as Buzz just described. If we allow the space station to be canceled, then we will be basically putting a moratorium on manned space development until some new era. And I would argue that we need to work hard as a nation, and we as citizens and as individuals, to see to it that we don't do that. We're a nation who can afford to continue manned exploration of space. And I hope everybody who hears this will be out there supporting it.
Let me add a little bit to what Skip and Dick have both said. I couldn't agree more about trying to get as many people as possible into space. I certainly would like to go myself. The issue isn't that we won't be able to do it. It is the steps that we take to get there. And right now, our plan with the space station is to understand, you could not now send someone and not good perfect health into space, because the health is affected by space flight. We need to understand that and prevent it. And by understanding those issues, such as bone loss, such as muscle loss, such as red cell mass changes, such as immunology changes, we're returning those studies to benefit health here on Earth. So there is a circle that's being completed in our space studies, but the primary reason that we started these studies and we found these changes were to make sure that we could take people into space, they would work there for unlimited periods of time and return healthy to Earth. Right now, we can't guarantee that. So that is a step. We will get there, and we've got plans to get there, and we'll get there on space station. And then the next step perhaps will be lottery tickets around the world to fly in space. Or your imagination can just go wild on how else we can get groups of people into space to enjoy the environment. But there is a step function that needs to occur, and we need to do it. We need to do it now, and we need to do it on a space station where there is enough laboratory space to do the kinds of work we need to do for the periods of time we need to do it, which has been our limitation.
You know, having to mobilize an experiment or a project like the Apollo mission, it's like we knew we could get there, we knew we could get back. We didn't know what it was going to do to Buzz. Thank you, Buzz. But there is a maturity to how many tasks there are on the table, what we have to understand. So it's getting better. The science is getting better. The technology is getting better. And the scope of the problem increases as we move forward. Now, General Horner, I want to ask you, what do you think we ought to do? Where do you think we ought to go?
Well, of course, we in the military are looking towards the short term. We don't need necessarily to have people in space to get the benefits of space for the military. I think over the long term, as our problems in the world become less and less, then I think we in the military and in the civil sector will be looking outward in space, looking towards interplanetary travel, looking towards economic exploitation of, say, the moon. Now, what the role of man in that is going to be a function of his physiology and the ability to withstand the rigors of space and the long times involved in space travel.
One of the things that I think is really important here is that many people see the space station, it goes on and on and back and up and down. Now we're in our latest incarnation. Tell us what's going to happen, and are we going to get funding for it? Skip, I'm looking at you.
Okay. Well, we are certainly, first of all, let me say that the space station has been redesigned in accordance with the instructions of President Clinton. The cost has been substantially lowered, and we are much more confident that we now have a robust space station design. We have a strong prime contractor in Boeing Aircraft. We have strong teams of scientists that are working, designing the laboratories together. The international folks are all working as an integrated part of our design team, and NASA, in reinventing itself, is becoming a strong manager like it used to be. It is going through what it is that industry went through in the past decade. NASA's management team for Space Station now has gone from 1,400 people to 340. They're using integrated team management and have hard numbers on the budgets. I believe this will bring the Congress around to recognize that we now know what it's going to cost to do this and that we can keep these costs in control. It's a very important aspect of this nation's interest to see Russia and the other nations involved. While some people would say that we're in the process of a giveaway of one sort or another, as far as the Russians are concerned, it couldn't be further from the truth. There is a technology capacity in Russia today. There are markets developing in Russia today. Our companies are joint venturing with them to take advantage of the areas in which they do have some advantages. Some of their rocket engines are the best in the world. I would rather have American companies capitalizing in these world markets than others. And if we don't move rapidly, then other nations will. So that we have competitive reasons, we have compelling foreign policy reasons, and we have some confidence with regard to cost. I think because of that, the Congress is going to be willing to support it. But anybody who is hearing this should encourage their congressmen and senators to do so.
Well, I think it's important, too, that there are many people in Congress who are opposing space station and encouraging the drop in the NASA budget because they say we can't afford this, and they were sent to Congress to cut the budget. In fact, what you have is a budget that's less than 1% of the federal budget for the space budget of NASA today. And what you have now is congressmen who are acting like the bully in the schoolyard. You know, let's pick on the smallest, weakest one around and clobber him. And because that's the easiest thing to do. There is no big constituency speaking out for space today. There is no American Dairy Association for space. And as someone without a great opportunity for the future, without an organization to argue for it, you end up with things happening that we kind of back into decisions that we really, as a nation, don't want. I think this is a defining moment in American history. It really is. This is a point where, for many different reasons, congressmen may and women may vote against space station, and then the next logical step is if you don't have space station, you don't need shuttle, and you have just killed the human presence in space from America. There will be continue to be a human presence in space, and it will move forward. And the question now is whether we're going to allow ourselves to stumble backward or whether and become the Portugal of the 21st century, or whether we're going to move forward in a systematic way and progress. And that's going to be, the decision's going to be made in Congress, and the only way they're going to decide that is based on what mail they receive from their constituents. That's a fact of life.
I couldn't agree more. We've come so far in defining our space program and moving ahead, and we've defined a space station. We've matured it tremendously in the last few years. I think we've brought on the international partners in a much more realistic way, and we've worked out ways to do things with the Russians. It would just be inexcusable for the American people or their representatives to turn their backs on human spaceflight at this point. We would almost be the laughingstock of the world if we were to do this. It's inconceivable that we could possibly not have some presence in space that we can then continue to visit. And exactly what that is, it's got to be something. Unfortunately, the way the political system works, it's all or nothing.
That
and
decision.
It cannot be nothing.
That's right. That decision, if the Congress made it to kill space station, would basically say, let's stick with consumerism today, with spending on what we want today and not invest in the future. And you cannot do that as a great nation.
There are other considerations as well in the course of defense conversion in a post-Cold War era. We are cutting back substantially and have been since 1987 in the defense establishment, as is natural, as the change of threat to the country is modified. We are down now to 908,000 in round numbers aerospace engineers. That's below 1 million for the first time since 1978. It dropped some 59,000 people last year and is due to decline again this year in the absence of station and the support activities that go with it. The United States will be headed towards becoming a second-class aerospace country.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. This special edition is live from the Public Radio Conference in San Antonio, Texas. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guests today are Apollo astronaut Buzz Aldrin, General Chuck Horner, Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Space Command, Dr. Carolyn Huntoon, Director of NASA Johnson Space Center, Skip Johns of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, and Dick McLeod of the U.S. Space Foundation. You know, I think many people don't realize how much of the American economy is owed to the technology and expertise which was created by the space program, how many jobs, many of the things that I learned, many things that I did, both from civilian and military standpoint, was a straight offshoot of the space program. How dependent are we on space to foster our economy in the years ahead? Skip?
Well, the GPS, the Global Positioning System, which was put in place by the Department of Defense and for the Department of Defense, is now turning out to be perhaps the most important navigational system in the world. I can, for my sailboat, get a handheld device that will tell me within 30 meters where I am anywhere in the world. It is astounding to be able to do that. You now have companies, Federal Express and others, that are able to use these devices in order to monitor, track, and send such simple things as getting packages to you. It's building a huge industry, and it's worldwide. And the United States is a leader in that because we put up the system. Global Cellular is a very likely competitor, bringing somewhere between 48 and 800, if you count the people who are talking, the largest number of satellites that would provide communications and data on a continuous and real-time basis at high data rates to everybody in the world. In terms of the defense community, I should leave to General Horner, but this is a critical part of our national defense, an ability to know what's going on everywhere in the world at one time, whether you're using it for targeting purposes or to assure yourself that the world's at peace. All of these are terribly important. The mission to Planet Earth, which is NASA's efforts to understand what's going on in our environment, are very important to our being able to do something about it. The communications, direct broadcast communications, which have just been applied for in licensing in this country, will be a new method of delivering the information highway to all the homes in America that have access to such a system. It will provide competition to, pardon the expression, cable, to broadcasters and to telephony as we evolve this information highway that you hear this administration talking about. The reason that we're pushing for that information highway is because it will radically improve the productivity of the way goods and services are delivered in the country, and that's what makes you a world competitor.
Now, General Horner, the military has always been a tremendous contributor to the general economy in developing jobs and industry, whole industries. Do you see that continuing in the future?
The problem we face with regard to military spending is we've been cut so severely. We're about half the size we were in 1986. Certainly, we're not nearly as strong as we were when we fought Desert Storm. Obviously, we don't need the military forces we needed during the height of the Cold War. But when we walk away from space spending, we walk away from support of fundamental technology, things like access to space, and there's other long-term things. For example, I could see where space-based defenses against ballistic missiles could lead to a denuclearization, where Russia, who's most threatened by these weapons, and the United States cooperating together could get rid of our nuclear arsenals if we could guarantee that Russia wouldn't be attacked from all the other countries possessing ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons to their south.
Now, here's an interesting question to me. When I look at the world, I'm starting to see grandparents get on the internet and they are sending email over to their grandchildren in China, and there is this enormous infrastructure that crosses national lines. It certainly can't be stopped by so much. What do we think is going to happen here from a military standpoint? Used to be the only people who could really communicate was the military. Now it seems like everybody can.
Well, during the Gulf War, it was interesting that both Saddam Hussein and our forces used the same comm satellite. So space is breaking for strange bedfellows, but I think in the long term it's very positive for mankind.
Knowing where you were as a troop in Desert Storm was a new thing, too, out in the middle of the desert, made possible by the global positioning system. Perhaps General Horner would describe some of the other specific advantages that that the space assets gave to our military on the ground.
Could you do that, General?
Well, I think information is the key to modern warfare, and just as it is to modern science, modern human interaction. So space really is primarily information, whether it be communication satellites or navigation information. We really rely on space for modern military operations. We call it knowledge warfare.
Now, let me just ask for a quick wrap-up from everybody. Do you think the space station's going to pass, Skip?
I certainly do, and I'm confident that we're going to proceed with a program that this nation can be proud of.
How about you, Carolyn?
Oh, well, certainly. That's our future, and we have to have the stepping stone to go back to the moon and to go to Mars and on beyond.
Buzz?
I think we will have a space station, and then I think it's imperative that we move ahead quickly on reusable space launch vehicles, two-stage and single-stage.
Dick?
Space station, if it were being voted on today in the Congress, would not pass, I don't believe. They insist on knowing the outcome. It's just sort of thing like asking the American Cancer Society to predict exactly what's going to happen with the dollars being put into it. And this is a research laboratory in space that they have to have, but you can't predict the results that are going to be produced from it, except that they will be wonderful.
How about you, General Horner? Do you have an opinion there?
The technology of space station and the efficiencies we can gain from repeatable access to space is going to help the military as well.
Well, Buzz, I've asked you about this before, so I'm going to hold off asking you for just a bit here. And I'm going to start with Skip. Now, Skip, Carolyn has arranged for us all to have seats on the next shuttle flight. And are you going to go?
Of course I'm going to go.
Well, Carolyn, you arranged this.
Certainly.
You're going to go. Dick?
No, I wouldn't.
You
would? I said, no way, I would not.
You would not? Okay, well, that's good.
How about you?
Now, General Horner, we have a note here from the President. He said, if you want to go, you can go. You going to go?
Well, I'll send someone younger, more capable, like Buzz.
That's great. Okay, everybody here in the studio audience, there's a seat with your name on it, and if you had to say right now, and if you did, you could, would you go? Raise your hand.
Absolutely.
Hey, look at this.
Every hand.
That's absolutely right. Now, if you're listening to my voice on an NPR station or community broadcaster nationwide, if you're one of 9 million Americans in 56 countries listening to my voice over Armed Forces Radio, or if you're one of 20 million users of the Internet in 110 countries who can hear us in digitized audio through Internet multicasting, there's a seat for you. And if you're ready to go, then I just want you to smile. Now, Buzz, I'm going to ask you this. I asked you before. Are you going to go?
You bet.
Ah! That's better than the last answer you gave me. I want to thank my guest today, Buzz Aldrin, space engineer, Gemini astronaut, and Apollo astronaut. I want to thank General Chuck Horner from Colorado Springs, Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Space Command, Dr. Carolyn Huntoon, Director of NASA Johnson Space Center, the first woman Space Center Director for NASA, Skip Johns, Associate Director for Technology at the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, and Dick McLeod, President of the U.S. Space Foundation. I want to dedicate this special edition of Tech Nation Live to Sidney Gutierrez, Kevin Chilton, Jerome Apt, Richard Clifford, Linda Godwin, and Thomas Jones, the crew members of the Space Shuttle Endeavour, who is at this moment flying shuttle mission STS-59, carrying the Space Radar Laboratory designed to focus on the environmental status of planet Earth. Mission Control informs us that Endeavour at this moment is orbiting at an altitude of 135 miles over western Canada. And whether you like it or not, Buzz, I'm going to dedicate this broadcast to you, because you made it all the way to the moon, 238,000 miles away, and thank the Lord you made it all the way back. And finally, I want to dedicate this broadcast to each of us, that we may look into ourselves and find that core, that kernel of daring, that we can dream daring dreams, so that we set high goals and bring ourselves to action, because we all know it's the quest that yields the rewards. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This special broadcast is brought to you by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Special thanks to Sue Bachtel and Barbara Bernstein of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, to Major Nelson McCouch of the U.S. Space Command, to Mark Hess of NASA Headquarters, to Jeff Carr, Hal Stahl, and Rob Navius of NASA Johnson Space Center, to Barry Grossman of the U.S. Space Foundation, to Jack Miller of the U.S. Space and Strategic Command, to Diane Coffey and Jan Jones of the U.S. Army Space Command Teleconferencing Facilities in Colorado Springs, and to Tom Basaga, Ed Clark, Joni James, Sonny Riddell, Gary Griffith, Larry Pegram and Chip Brown of AT&T for providing civilian teleconferencing equipment and link-up. And special thanks for additional support from KALW-FM and KVIA-FM in San Francisco and Scranton, Pennsylvania. Associate producer for TechNation Americans in Technology is Monte Carlos. Special producers for TechNation Live are Frank Braun and Jacques Verdier. Additional technical support provided by Pat Cayley and Erica Funky. Music direction by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Title creation for TechNation was provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Your interview host is Dr. Moira Gunn. For TechNation, I'm Jerry Jacob. This special production of TechNation Live is produced in association with KQED-FM in San Francisco. TechNation, Americans in Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.